Okay, we are live in the Borghino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village, New York City. I would like to welcome everybody. As we always start out, for those of you who have never been here before, welcome. To those who have been to the clubhouse before, welcome home. It's a pleasure tonight to welcome Marty Dobrow, the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door. This is a fantastic book. I really enjoyed it. And just many of you here know Marty, but for those of you who don't, or for those of you listening to the podcast, just quickly, Marty is an associate professor at Springfield College. He has written for the Boston Globe, Sports Illustrated, ESPN.com, and the International Herald Tribune. Five of Marty's pieces have earned recognition in the Best American Sports Writing Series. And normally with a bio, you kind of just read this and the words just come out and you don't really think about it. And as I was writing out Marty's bio, I just want to make a note of this where it says five of your pieces have been in the Best American Sports Writing Series. That's basically, you're like a five-time All-Star. And there are not that many five-time All-Stars out there. So it's really a pleasure to welcome you tonight. And my first question to get us going is basically what drew you to this subject of following these six minor leaguers and this small group of kind of mom-and-pop agents who represent all six. What drew you to this?
Well, Jay, first, thanks so much for having me here. It's great to be here. One of the real benefits of the hard labor of writing a book is the number of people that it brings together from your past, and it's wonderful looking out here and seeing members of my family, friends from my high school days, people I haven't seen in quite some time who have come here and taken time out of their schedule to be here tonight. So I really appreciate your setting this up. In terms of what drew me to the book, I would say this. Always loved baseball from a very young age. Got into it through my dad, who's here, who grew up just one block away on 10th Street. And I think the appeal for me of the game is because baseball is the game that has the best stories. And for me, I think the best stories in baseball are in the minor leagues. That's the place of yearning. It's the place of heartbreak. It's the place of what I call in the book the agony or the anguish of almost. Players who are so close to something they want so much, but something they still might not get. And there was something about that dynamic that I think represents the ingredients, really, of a great story. So that was the draw for me.
It's very interesting. Yeah, the anguish of almost, when I read that, it really resonated. As we spoke about, I was a sports agent for 15 years, kind of in this situation for many of it, and it is the anguish of almost.
Yeah, it's such a hard world to crack. I mean, I think we have a sense of professional athletes in our culture, people who make enormous sums of money. Indeed, the minimum salary in Major League Baseball this year in 2011, I believe, is $410,000. The average salary in Major League Baseball is over $3 million. And yet you have players who have been in the minor leagues for 5 and 6 years, very talented athletes who are making maybe $10,000 to $15,000 a year. And it's a separation that's unlike almost anything else in the culture, because you look at sort of near great doctors, they're still making a lot of money, but not so in baseball. They try to keep those people very hungry. And you get that sense of yearning, you get the temptation to cut corners. It's really written large in the minor league lifestyle.
Now, when you started this project, I know all this because I lived through it, but did you know this, or were you surprised by what you found?
That's a great question. I think I knew some of it because I've been a big baseball fan from way back. I remember actually going to some minor league games with my dad, but a lot of it was surprising to me. It was surprising to me how hard the life is. And that was what I found recurrently in this, and that I wanted to give life to these stories. These are players, by and large, that most fans have not heard about. But I was banking on the fact that their stories were interesting enough and that I could tell them in a compelling enough way that it would really matter to readers. I think that we have people who have made it as Major League Baseball players, by and large, we don't have a real sense of association with anymore. They're making so much money. They're living lifestyles that most people cannot really relate to. We can relate to minor leaguers. I think that's a lot of us in our lives are in that situation of really yearning mightily for something and not knowing if it's going to come true.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did a great job. It was a compelling story of these six guys. And I think we should get into some of that.
Sure.
The first thing is I just want to read the names of the six ball players because just their names alone tell a story. And it couldn't have been better if you made these names up, basically. Manny Del Carmen, Charlie Zink, Doug Clark, Randy Ruiz, Brad Baker, and Matt Tora. It's spelled differently, but we'll use him as the Old Testament guy. And it covers baseball. I mean, these are the six names that make up baseball, basically. And when you said they had these compelling stories, it's very true. I mean, for example, maybe we can start with Charlie Zink, let's say.
Sure.
And I just have a little summary from what you wrote. Charlie Zink, these are Marty's words, much better than mine. The color never stops with Zink. He grew up in California, the son of two guards at the famed Folsom State Prison. He went to a Division III art school in Georgia, where he was coached improbably by former Red Sox legend Louis Tiant. Late in his first year in the minors, he became a knuckleballer overnight after a just-for-fun knuckler shattered the Oakley sunglasses of a coach. Zeke even has a glamorous girlfriend named Madeline Monroe. Perfect.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie was really a writer's dream, is a writer's dream, because he's just one of these people who just is sort of irresistibly drawn in his days, in the air that he breathes, to drama at the highest level, despite the fact that he's a very mellow, soft-spoken guy. But he has all of these things in his life that are so preposterous. The son of two Folsom prison guards. His dad actually was the associate warden at the Folsom prison. That's the Folsom of Johnny Cash fame, and where Charles Manson, among others, was incarcerated. And Charlie's dad was the associate warden, nicknamed Cobra. His mom is this diminutive 5'1" Japanese American woman whose family was sent to an internment camp during World War II. So she kind of comes at the notion of incarceration from another angle. And they had one child with this appealing name, Charlie Zink, and was a very good athlete, but wound up playing, as you referenced there, his college baseball at the Savannah College of Art and Design in Georgia, which is hardly your standard job proving ground. It's a Division III school, but Louis Tiant, in fact, was the coach there for 4 years. And through Tiant, Zink got a tryout with the Red Sox. He was signed, symbolically enough, on April 1st, 2002. For no bonus whatsoever and a monthly salary of $850. And it was late in that first season in the minor leagues when he became a knuckleballer, quite by accident. He'd never thrown a knuckleball in a game before, and he was just having a catch with a strength and conditioning coach, a big burly guy who was wearing these Oakley sunglasses, and sort of mischievously, Charlie gripped the pitch as a knuckleball, and it just had this wild motion. Smacked him right in the eye, shattered the Oakley sunglasses, and three stitches above the eye later, Zink was anointed a knuckleballer in the Tim Wakefield mode and wound up having a preposterous rise and fall and rise again through in the Red Sox system that culminated in a one-game call-up on August 12, 2008, which in classic Zink fashion was a ridiculous baseball game. I was there. I sat between his mom, the former Folsom prison guard, Joyce Zink, his dad had since passed away, and his then-girlfriend, now-wife, Madeline Monroe. And in the first inning, this is after, you know, 8 years into his minor league career, first inning, he's going up against the Texas Rangers, who begin the World Series tomorrow night. And three guys who are going to be in that lineup, all All-Stars, Ian Kinsler, Michael Young, Josh Hamilton, gets them out 1-2-3 in the first inning. And then in the bottom of the first, the Red Sox wind up scoring 10 runs David Ortiz hits 2 3-run home runs in the bottom of the first. But Zink does not hold the lead. He's out by the fifth inning. The Red Sox wind up winning the game by the preposterous score of 19-17, tying a 50-year-old American League record for most runs scored in a game. This is just the way it is with this guy. It's just nonstop cover. He was sent back to the minor leagues that very night. It was tremendously gracious. The scene in the bowels of Fenway Park outside the locker room with his mom and his girlfriends, with a bunch of his college friends from the Savannah College of Art and Design, who had basically said, if you make it, we will come. And in fact, they did. I mean, they came from all points to come cheer Charlie on. It was an amazing night, really one of the most remarkable reporting nights I could imagine.
It's an amazing story, and it's not that uncommon of a story in some ways. Yeah. In other ways, it is. And what happened to Charlie? Do you know where he is now?
I do. Charlie continued to pitch. He was with the Red Sox organization through 2009. The magic that he had in 2008, which he was actually the AAA Pitcher of the Year in the International League, completely vanished. And this is often the way it is with knuckleballers. The edge of command is very tight. And it's either there in a huge way or it vanishes. And it vanished in 2009. He was not re-signed by the Red Sox. In 2010, he signed with the Twins organization, pitched just 3 games there, wound up hurting his shoulder, had surgery, pitched independent baseball this year in 2011 for the Lancaster Barnstormers. Right now is out of baseball, but knuckleballers have a long shelf life. He might well be back, and I hope for all of our sakes that he is, because he's really quite a character.
Yeah, it's amazing. And what, before we get to some of the other guys, how did you decide on these six? Was it through the agent?
Yeah.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about this agent group as well.
Sure.
Which came first, basically?
Right, that's also a good question. I mean, basically the criteria that I had in selecting characters for this were the following. One, most important, I wanted people who had great human interest stories. I knew that I wanted to interview these people over years, it had to be really compelling to me if I felt I had a chance to make it compelling for readers. So that was quite the most important thing. Two is that I wanted some degree of geographical proximity, because this was, writing is a big passion of mine, but my full-time job is I teach journalism at Springfield College in Massachusetts, and I have a family. I don't have an unlimited budget for travel, so I had to make sure that I, since I needed a lot of access, and I wanted these to be intimate stories, not just about the players, but about the wives and girlfriends and people who have latched on to the dream. So that dictated a bit of a local focus. So 4 of the 6 players are from Massachusetts. And then 2 of them were players whose just human interest stories were, I just couldn't resist. Zink was one and Randy Ruiz was another. The third criteria, besides the great stories and proximity, was that they were all represented by the same group of agents. It's a husband and wife agent team, and you know from your own experience, Jay, that you know a woman in the world of baseball agency is very rare. It's really a testosterone-laced world. And so she plays a really interesting role, Lisa Master-Alexis and her husband Jim, and their third partner, Steve McKelvey. And I basically regard the agents as characters in the book, too. They're in this parallel place. They've been slogging away at their own baseball dream for many years that may or may not come true. Essentially, I had 9 people, 6 players, 3 agents. You know, 9's a good number for baseball. 9 innings, 9 players on the field. It seemed like a good number of characters, too.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I thought was terrific in the book, the way you brought the agents and the players together in this journey. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, basically. There's such an image of an agent, of they're all Scott Boras, basically, when that's very untrue.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that in the modern imagination, agents are not usually thought of as sympathetic characters. I mean, we have, you know, images from the Tom Cruise movie, from Scott Boras in real life, from the old show Arliss. I mean, it seems kind of oily and unsavory. And yet I developed, you asked me before, what surprised me about this. One thing that surprised me is just how hard a job an agent has. They're often with these players for years and years and years, making no money at all when they're in the minor leagues. None. And they don't really make any money until maybe they make it in the big leagues. And even then, it's only that once they've been there for 3 years and they start making more than the big league minimum, that the agent's 4 to 5% cut really kicks in. So it's totally speculative. and players can leave agents at a moment's notice. In fact, one of the players here, Randy Ruiz, who we might talk about a bit later, who the agents were with for years through really hard things, helped them through this whole steroids crisis in 2005. Once he made it, he dumped them for other agents. So it's a tough life.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that, yeah. I can personally vouch for that part of the story, which happens all the time. Yeah. All the time. It's one of the things that turned me personally off to being an agent any longer, is that it's just a complete free-for-all. And as you said, a player is allowed to leave an agent at any time, which I understand the reasons why that happens, but it doesn't work as a business. Everything's funneled into this handful of agents who have all the power, basically. So let's talk about Randy Ruiz. Okay. And as you wrote, raised by his grandmother in a Section 8 apartment in the Bronx, Ruiz became baseball's Gulliver. 6 colleges, 9 different big league organizations, 3 minor league batting titles, 2 suspensions for alleged steroid use, once traded for no compensation, a AAA Rookie of the Year at age 30, a AAA MVP at 31, a taste of big league nectar, a year in Japan, sometimes sleeps with his bat. Whatever you want to say about Randy, as well as what happened to this relationship with the agents, I think that's a very interesting part of the story.
Yeah, Randy was a very compelling character to me. I mean, he grew up here in the South Bronx. His parents, I believe, were 16 and 15 when they had him. He was not raised by either of them. He was raised by his grandmother. I've been to his apartment in the South Bronx. It's very, it's a tough place. I can still see the 4 locks across the door. And there's no doubt, very, very tough life, and baseball was it. He has an interesting New York baseball story in that he went to James Monroe High School in the Bronx, and the single season home run record at James Monroe High School, once held by Hank Greenberg, baseball Hall of Famer, broken by Ed Cranepool, who played for the 1962 original Mets and the 1969 Miracle Mets, and then that home run record broken again by Randy Ruiz. So he's got that interesting part of his heritage. And then he had this wild zigzagging path, a lot of different school programs, a lot of different professional organizations. And finally in 2005, which I believe was his 6th year in the minor leagues, he got his first call up to AA. And in AA, he had this double-edged season for the ages where he almost won the Triple Crown. He led the Eastern League in batting that year, won the batting title, almost led in home runs and RBIs, despite the fact that he served both a 15 and a 30-game suspension for failing the steroids test, and which is just rather remarkable. Now, I am not by any means an apologist for performance-enhancing drug use in professional baseball or elsewhere, but when you really look into the world of minor league baseball, you see how difficult it is for these guys. They see other people who are cutting corners illegally, that edge where they're making tons and tons of money, and you can understand how that kind of decision gets made. Is it the right decision? No, I don't think it is, but I think it is kind of understandable. So that was an interesting element in Ruiz's story. And he was a lot of years also. I mean, this was not someone who was a top draft pick at all. He was actually signed out of a tryout camp, $1,000 bonus. Very low salary. He was working off-season in Nebraska, where one of the places he'd gone to junior college. Off-season, third shift, stocking shelves in a supermarket in the winter in Nebraska to support his baseball habit. It's a tough life, no doubt about it. Ultimately, Ruiz did get a call up to the big leagues in 2008 with the Twins. I flew out to Minnesota to be there. I missed his debut, but I was there for his second and third games. I tried to be there at all the sweet moments, because there are so many hard moments. And the moments when players break through are so rich and so colorful and so cinematic that it was important for me to do everything I could to try to be there. And, I think 4 of the 6 players who I write about did get at least a taste of the big leagues. In Charlie Zink's case, it was just for one day. But I tried to be there in that most precious moment in every case.
And if you could just talk a little bit about Ruiz's relationship with the agents and, sure. and what happened, because I think that's enlightening.
I think it is. I mean, he had the agents basically, I mean, we think about agents as just in terms of money, but they do so many other things. I mean, they're essentially professional babysitters in a lot of ways. They have to take care of people's travel. They have to disconnect their utilities. They provide them with equipment in the minor leagues. You know, they often fly into these minor league cities and help, you know, take their guys out to dinner. They're doing a lot of things to help support these guys. And in Randy Ruiz's case, he, during that double-edged season of 2005, where he was in Reading, Pennsylvania, which is a great baseball city, but it's a harsh place if you're not doing well. And the local press was just crucifying him after his failing these steroids tests. And the agents did heroic work on his behalf, and I choose that word quite consciously. And it was exceedingly difficult what they did for him. Ultimately, years later, he broke through in 2008, briefly with the Twins, and 2009 and 10 with Toronto. And just as it seemed that he was on the cusp of really making it in a big way, Ruiz wound up leaving them for larger agents. That happens all the time. Larger agents, you know, there's a lot of stuff that they can provide that other agents can't. You look at someone like Scott Boras, he provides sports psychologists. He provides these wonderful training facilities that other agents just can't afford. And so it's, you know, it's one of those cases of the big guy having all the advantages. We have a lot of that in our culture.
You brought back a flood of emotion about Reading, Pennsylvania, I'll tell you that. Okay, let's go to Manny Del Carmen. Yeah. When the book begins in 2005, Del Carmen is entering his fifth year as a minor leaguer in the Red Sox organization. The son of a minor leaguer who never advanced beyond single A, Manny grew up in Boston rooting for the Sox. He's a hard-headed young man who once went AWOL in the minors, storming home from Georgia before getting two flat tires in the South Bronx at 4 a.m.
Yeah, Manny is quite a story. He's grew up in inner city Boston and had that common inner city Boston dream of playing for the Red Sox. Almost never happens. I mean, the odds are so stacked against you. He was the first player from a public high school in Boston to be drafted, I believe, in 30-something years by the Red Sox, and he wound up ultimately surpassing what his dad did as. You know, most minor leaguers, 90% of minor leaguers do not make it. You have to be a great athlete to become a minor league baseball player. It's a considerable achievement. Almost all these guys in the minor leagues were the best players in their high schools, best players in their counties. You know, really terrific, terrific athletes. But even though they've survived all of this winnowing, the odds are still stacked against them. 90% of them won't make it. Manny Del Carmen's dad did not, but Manny did. And in 2005, he finally got the call up to the big leagues, and I was able to watch that again quite closely. I sort of tell the story through his best friend in Boston, who was a bus driver for an MBTA buses in Boston, and who was listening to Manny's debut down in Tampa Bay, and couldn't believe, here's his best friend, as this bus driver is making this route back and forth, he's got the game on the radio, and hearing Manny has made it. Manny's second game was in Boston at the mound that he grew up, you know, would go to Fenway quite a bit as a kid, watching baseball games there. And after that game, he got invited to David Ortiz's house in the leafy suburban, you know, enclave of Newton. And this bus driver also got a chance to go. And this bus driver tells great stories about what it's like being in Ortiz's house. He can't believe it. He goes into the bathroom and there's David Ortiz's image on the soap in the bathroom. it was really the sweetness of that moment was really fun to watch. And Del Carmen wound up pitching for the Red Sox in the 2007 World Series. But even he's probably the guy who made it the most of any of these players because he was part of major league seasons from 2005 to 2010. But you know, he was never even an A-list player, and his career is perhaps on the way out too. So it's such a hard life. If you really make it, you're rewarded in all kinds of ways, financially, and in the biggest way, I think, you get to live what you yearn for as a kid, which almost none of us do. But it's very rare to see it happen.
And where is Manny now?
Manny is back in Boston, hoping to get a phone call. He had played for two different organizations this year. He was with most recently with the Texas organization, started the year with Seattle, did not pitch well. His velocity is down. I think he's got some undiagnosed shoulder problems. So he's really at a crossroads in his career. He was released by the Rangers organization this summer, in the summer of 2011, and it's possible that he's done too. So it's, you know, the happy endings are rare, but the sweet moments are still, you know, are still worth it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let's go through the other three, then we'll ask, we'll open it up for some questions.
Great.
Doug Clark. Clark has a fascinating perspective on performance-enhancing drug use in the minors. He has a biology degree. He comes from a family of teachers. And for the first 8 years of his career, he was a left fielder in the Giants organization, an understudy to Barry Bonds. Clark's odyssey includes 10 years in the minors, three in Korea, lots of winter ball in Mexico, and one of the most dramatic call-ups in baseball history.
Right, and those are big words to live up to, but I think he does live up to them. Doug Clark played 8 years in the Giants organization as a left fielder, the understudy to Barry Bonds. Bonds, obviously, the all-time home run leader. And Doug Clark was just a good soldier, basically, working hard, climbing through the ranks. In 2005, his eighth year in the minors, he thought this was the year that he was going to finally get the call-up. He hit .316 in AAA, the highest rung of the minor league ladder, had 13 home runs, I believe it was 30 doubles, 29 stolen bases. And in September, in Major League Baseball, Major League teams expand their rosters. Your roster is 25 players during the season. In September, it can go up to as many as 40. And so it's an opportunity for minor leaguers who have had a great season to finally get that reward. And Doug Clark was convinced that this was going to be the time. Much to his tremendous, bitter disappointment, that was not the case. And he flew back, really feeling disconsolate, flew back to Springfield, Massachusetts, where he grew up. And he went back to work as a substitute teacher in the high school where he had gone, inner city school in Springfield. And it's now mid-September. There are basically no more call-ups happening. And he's teaching a social studies class, has turned his cell phone off. He's teaching this class about civil rights. And he hears a rapping on the door. And through one of those narrow slivers of glass that you have in a high school classroom, he sees his dad. And often that's a bad sign, an unexpected visit from a family member. That often portends bad news. And Doug ushered him into the room, and there are all these high school students there, and he sort of awkwardly introduces his dad to the crowd, said, "This is Bill Carr. You know, he put the lights on here on the Central High School football field, and you know, these are my students." And Bill Carr just whispered to him, "Doug, you've got to call the Giants." And a couple hours later, he was down at Bradley Airport in Windsor Locks, Connecticut, flying first class for the first time in his life, heading out to San Francisco. There had been two injuries in the Giants game the night before. They tried to reach him on his cell phone, but it was shut off because he was teaching. And so that day, you know, I couldn't fly out for the beginning of his career, but what I did, I went the next morning to Central High School, and I heard the morning announcements. There's this secretary in the office who gives the announcements. Her name is Dolores Cronella, 72-year-old woman. And she starts the announcements by saying, "First, we'd like to congratulate Doug Clark, Central High graduate, was in here substituting. He was called up by the San Francisco Giants. Congratulations. Also, detention begins today in room 126. So that was a sort of precious moment. And then later that day, there was an afternoon game in San Francisco. And the Clark family, wonderful family, seven kids in the family. Doug grew up sharing a room with two brothers in the basement of that house. And the family was very gracious. They allowed me to come in and watch the game with them in their living room. And so there was a very, very sweet scene there. So he's kind of an interesting story, too. He has one major league hit to his credit. One in all these years. He's still playing. He's 35 years old. He's playing in Mexico. He's 1-for-11 with an .091 major league batting average. To a lot of people, that would represent abject failure. To me, it represents grand success. It's quite an impressive story.
Beautiful. Brad Baker. Baker grew up in Leyden, Massachusetts, a rural town with no stores or streetlights, but lots of deer and bear that he loved to hunt. Red Sox scouts watched every pitch he threw his senior year, and the team selected him in the first sandwich round of the 1999 draft. The rigors and ruthlessness of pro ball took their toll on Baker as he climbed the ranks, carrying the hopes of his small town on his shoulders.
Brad Baker's really the genesis of this book. Back in 1999, I had an assignment for Sport Magazine. It unfortunately no longer exists. One of the last issues of the magazine, I got to write a story about the baseball draft, focusing on one kid and one family. And I wanted somebody who I would, again, would have close access to. And there happened to be a player who was pegged to go high in the draft that year named Brad Baker. And I drove up to this tiny town, Leiden, Mass. There are under 1,000 people there. No stores, no streetlights. Their house is kind of this rural paradise. They've got fishing poles and buckets on the porch, you know, deer racks and bear pelts in the living room, and the Red Sox game always on the radio. And that day, Baker was picked in the first round of the draft by the Red Sox. And there was this very sweet scene. His dad said, Jim Baker said that day, "This is the greatest day of my life." That's his father speaking. His uncle, who's a big person in this book, who has a kind of a tragic story about him, he had been diving off a covered bridge there and broke his neck when he was a teenager. It was that had been a great athlete. He was a huge fan of Brad's. He was there just beaming beneath his Red Sox cap. So that really became the genesis of the book, although I didn't conceptualize it as a book quite then. Brad wound up playing in the minors from 1999 to 2007, never made it, got as far as AAA, the AAA All-Star game, but that was the end of the road for Brad.
Wow. And the sixth ball player, Matt Torra, a first round pick of the Diamondbacks in 2005, Torra tore his labrum only 10 innings into his pro career. Just a year before, baseball injury guru Will Carroll had written, "If pitchers with torn labrums were horses, they'd be destroyed." Torra has been trying to fight his way back ever since.
Yeah, you get a sense of how hard this life is, because here's a guy who is first-round draft choice, 31st pick in the entire country in the 2005 draft, top pick in New England, led the nation in ERA for any college pitcher in America in 2005. I went out to Yakima, Washington to see him during the first week of his professional career, but 10 innings into his professional career, he had this devastating injury, tore the labrum in his pitching shoulder. And that's 2005. Here it is now, 2011. He's still at it. He actually wound up, I thought maybe he might get the call this year. It didn't happen. He was traded to Tampa Bay this year and wound up getting very hot at the end of the year and had a great year in Durham, North Carolina for the Durham Bulls of Bull Durham fame. So he's had to reconfigure himself entirely because of this injury. He doesn't throw as hard as he did when he was in college. Can't get the torque to get good break on his curveball, but has really slogged away, and you know, he's still got a fighting chance. It would be great to see it happen.
Something. They're all six stories are any of the six could have been its own book, basically. And you really did a beautiful job with all of these guys.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was really a total labor of love, because I found the stories very, very interesting. Six is a big number. I mean, asks a lot of readers to say, I want you to care about all of these characters, people you haven't heard of, about. Six players, three agents. That's a lot to keep in the air. But I just felt that the stories were unique enough and compelling enough that I could pull it off. And I hope if you read the book, you agree.
You did. You definitely did. Let's see if anybody has any questions from our gallery.
Mark. As somebody who knows that you yourself have Major League Baseball talent, I was wondering why you chose journalism.
This question comes from a very kind friend of mine from way back when, Mark Gimple, who obviously overstates my athletic ability to many, many degrees. But I actually got my start in journalism thanks to Mark, because we grew up on Long Island in Great Neck, and there's a weekly newspaper there called the Great Neck Record. And there's a column that is written about high school sports that a senior gets to write. And Mark is a year ahead of me in school, wrote that column during his senior year, and he passed the torch very generously to me. I remember making $5 a week for that column and thinking, what a great life. Journalism is where it's at.
Lee? Did any of the players meet each other?
The players do have, some of the players have some connection. That's an interesting question because often, you know, you have a sports book will sort of follow a team and the success of the team is the drama on which this is based. That's not the case here because they're playing often on different teams. The connective tissue, again, is the agent. But Charlie Zink and Manny Del Carmen were both in the Red Sox organization for many years together and went through a lot together. And I focus quite a bit on their friendship. Because in the minor leagues, friendship is extremely rare. In fact, players are often told when they're drafted, don't get too close to people in the minor leagues. It's just, the life is too hard. People get traded. People get released. And there's, even though we like to think of the minor leagues as this very sweet world, you know, and in some ways it is. It's all these sort of schlocky between innings promotions and the mascots and the earnest little leaguers hovering over the railing for autographs. That's all true. Wonderful family entertainment. It's also a savage world where one person's success is kind of bad for you if they play the same position that you do. And that another person's injury is kind of good for you. And so that mitigates against friendship. But once in a while, it does happen. And their case was very interesting because they were both pitchers in the Red Sox organization. But they helped each other through some really difficult times. When Charlie Zink's dad died, Manny was extremely helpful. When Manny had major elbow surgery, Charlie was extremely helpful. And one of the neat things is that the one-game call-up that I referenced earlier, that wild 19-17 game, Del Carmen was with the Red Sox at that point. And so there's, you know, they came together, they're stretching in the outfield. Zink was going to be starting that night. I was out on the field getting, and in the clubhouse, getting as much color as I could. And there's a picture that was taken that I didn't realize was even being snapped when they were coming in from the outfield. And of the two of them together. And you see just half of my face, and I'm just absolutely beaming. And it's, you know, you try not, as a journalist, to be too attached to the outcome. But you get a sense, when you've been inside their story so much, how hard a life this has been. And to be there in that moment, to be able to experience that sweetness, was so gratifying. I think it was reflected on that half of my face that's visible in the picture.
Do you know if Zink ever talked to Kinsler about their backgrounds? Because I've read that Kinsler's father is a retired warden and a Tucson.
Is that right? Well, I don't know if they ever did. That's interesting. I know that Zink actually did play to extend the incarceration theme with him a little bit. His first professional experience, actually, was he played five innings with the team in Yuma, an independent team in the Yuma Territorial Prison, which my dad actually told me, pointed out this connection when he read an early draft of this book. Pointed out, said, that's kind of interesting. So I don't know if he made the connection with Kinsler, but next time I speak to him, I will we'll bring that to his attention. Yes?
How did the players come to know and meet and choose their agents?
Interesting question. I think that the connection, often it's word of mouth. When players are doing really well in the minor leagues, they often come back to their hotel room and see that light flashing. And, you know, agents will call and say, I'm in town, you know, I'd love to take you out to dinner. There's a lot of wooing that happens. But players learn early on that they want someone that they can really trust and count on. And these particular agents try to sell a model of intimacy, of sort of family-oriented. Since it is, after all, a husband and wife and their good friend, that they say, you know, we're not like Scott Boras. You know, we're going to be there for you. We we want to connect with your family. That's the way they sold it. And for a certain group of players, I think that worked pretty well. But still, the odds are so stacked against the little guy in the agent world that it's this group of agents is still struggling mightily. Even after this book, I think they were hoping that this was going to be the thing that was going to catapult them into the big time, but it hasn't happened for them. I don't know that it's really happened for me either, but still was worth doing. Yes,
Marty, what are the numbers again that of the number of players that are drafted every year to go to one of the baseball team affiliates? How many players are drafted?
Basically, there are 1,500 players are drafted. What happens in the first week of June, there's a draft that replenishes the talent pool. And there are 30 teams, and each team is allowed to make 50 selections over 3 days in the draft. And so not every team makes all 50 selections, but most come pretty close. So basically, there are 1,500 players who are drafted, and that's the new talent pool. You know, those are the new young studs that come in. And if you've been in the minor leagues, you're always looking over your shoulder at those guys because those are the guys coming up. Obviously, there are players who come in from other places, too, because baseball is an international game. And the players outside, currently, outside of the United States, Canada, and Puerto Rico, are not subject to the draft. So when your beloved Boston Red Sox fished Daisuke Matsusaka out of Japan, a move that was probably not too financially, didn't show a lot of financial savvy as events have played out, he was not subject to the draft. And a lot of those players from Latin America are not subject to the draft either. So that's why there are these big baseball academies down in Latin America right now. They're trying to find these players in the Dominican Republic and Venezuela. It's possible that the draft will become a worldwide draft. There is a movement to have that happen. Matt?
I wanted to say, first of all, this is a wonderful book. I was so happy reading it. It's really just delightfully told. I recommend it highly.
Thank you.
I don't know that people watching, you know, a typical person watching a baseball game is aware of just how sharply delineated the difference is between living in close to poverty and living in extreme wealth.
Yes.
Exists in the game of baseball, that you could be making, as you said, $10,000 a year or making $10 million a year. Why do you think it is that this system has been allowed to exist, where there's such a difference between the minors and the majors? Is it because there's not a union among the minor league players, and is the Major League Baseball Players Union, do they have any sense of concern at all in trying to improve the conditions of people who may one day join their union?
There is no minor league union, and that's part of it. So those players are not protected at all. And I think in part it exists because they want to keep these players incredibly hungry. And a way of doing that is to pay them so minimally that they're willing to do almost anything. Unfortunately, almost anything sometimes means taking performance-enhancing drugs, which is much more rampant in the minor leagues than it is in the major leagues. So I think that is a big piece of it, that the major league teams pay the minor league salaries, but it's such a small amount of money. And it's essentially, they are banking, they're exploiting these players because the dream is still so appealing. It's such a draw, it's so compelling that these players are willing to put up with this because they just want a taste, the chance to be able to live this rare and wonderful experience.
On the other hand, if you compare, baseball is really the only sport that has a minor league apprenticeship as opposed to a free college apprenticeship.
Right.
So in a way, that's a condition of all major league sports.
I mean, has the Major League Players Union made any efforts to try to improve the contractual conditions of the minor league players?
Minimally. I mean, not really a lot. I mean, I think players in the minor leagues, if you become a minor league free agent, and that's after you have played, it's a six-year minor league free agent. It's actually only after you play for 7 years that kicks in, because the clock doesn't start till the end of the first year. I think that's how it goes. You probably know that better than I would, Jay. But at that point, if you are still deemed worthy of continuing to play, then you have a chance to make a semblance of a decent salary. So you have people in the minor leagues then making, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. And if you've been in the major leagues even for one day, that kicks you into a whole other pay structure so you can begin to make a decent salary in the minor leagues. So not everyone is surviving on you know, those kind of wages, but a great many people are. Is it exploitative? I think it definitely is. It's a very, very hard life. And most people, I agree with you, I think most people have no sense of it. Just how hard that is. Hey, Mark.
Marty, you know, why do you think baseball is so romantic? You know, you've experienced this from, like many of us, more than many of us, from different angles. You played in high school. We played together.
Yeah.
You wrote about it. You were a spectator. You were a fan. I'm not going to ask what your favorite team is, but I think you'll agree that many people perceive baseball to be very romantic. And why is that?
That is a good question. I think people definitely do. Some of it, I think, speaks probably to the pace of the game. It's a much more contemplative game than, you know, football or basketball. It plays to our imagination. It's a great game on the radio. it's a game that I think really speaks to our sense of narrative and to story. And I really think that as a species, we're kind of wired into the need for story. Young kids are always asking, you know, little children, tell me a story, read me a story. Why do we flock to the movies so much? Great movies are great stories. I mean, you can take the best actors, the best special effects, couple them with a terrible script, that's not going to be a very good movie. We love that sense of being transported, and I think that baseball does that better than any other game. There's something about it that just plays to that sense of the imagination and plays to the sense of story. And that, again, the yearning and the heartbreak are almost tangible in baseball.
I actually lied. I want to know who you were rooting for.
I grew up mightily rooting for the Mets, and I see that the Mets, the little on this particular base, the Yankees base, but the Mets napkins are on top of that, which I'm happy to see. Yeah, the 69 Mets were really, I mean, I can still vividly remember, I was 8 years old when the Mets won it all in 1969, but I have uncanny sense of particulars of many of those games and where I was and what happened. And there was the end of that season, after the Mets won it all in 1969, there was a store near our homes in Great Neck. Now, it hasn't been there for decades now, but the Abraham and Strauss department store. And there was a day in like December of 69 or January of 1970, something like that, where Tom Seaver was on the junket tour, was doing something for Bragi Cologne, another product that I think has been long gone from the earth for decades. But he was going to be appearing. And my mother, you know, earning an eternal place in you know, baseball heaven, got me out of school early in third grade to the great consternation of my classmates, some of whom are assembled here. And I was the first person of hundreds, I believe, maybe 1,000, online at the Abraham and Strauss store. And I had made this collage that I have to this day that's about the Miracle Mets season. He signed it to Martin, which is what I was called back then. To Martin, best wishes. And you've made a number one poster, Tom Seaver. And I was not ready to relinquish my spot in line, so I sort of beckoned him down and uttered, you know, whispered in his ear these immortal words: when I grow up, I want to be just like you. Obviously, it didn't happen, and so, you know, wound up writing about the game. So, next best thing. So, thank you so much.
We're gonna end the podcast there, and Tom Seaver was my boyhood idol as well, and maybe that's what brought us together. Yeah. I don't normally do this, but I went back and I looked at how this came about, and it's very interesting because you sent me an email. You were referred by Richard Michelson, an author who was here with a book about Lippmann Pike, which was terrific, and Ben Shapiro, another terrific writer who's here tonight, and your email said these guys said I should contact you, and then a letter dated on Abraham Lincoln's birthday, actually. And I just want to read the first paragraph of the letter that you wrote me. I don't mean to embarrass you, but dear Jay, here is the copy of Knocking on Heaven's Door, Six Minor Leaguers in Search of the Baseball Dream. Sorry for the delay. I had hoped to send it out to you at the beginning of this week, but ran out of copies after making a presentation to the Amherst Rotary Club. That speaks to the grassroots effort behind book promotion. I tell friends that I consider this the little book that could. You have the little-known players slogging away at their hard baseball dreams, the three agents in their parallel quest, the author doing the same thing. It's a big challenge, but great fun. And this has been great fun.
It really has.
I'm very happy that you sent this letter to me back in February, and it's been an honor having you, your dad who grew up around the corner, your uncle. It's really a lot of your old friends and family are here, and it's really been a pleasure and a special evening.
Well, it's been a joy for me. It really has been great fun. I so appreciate all you people taking time out of your busy lives to come be a part of this. It's been great fun and an unforgettable night for me. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right.